Hi, this is Seth Jordan, and you are listening to Shane Christopher Neal.
So with Taylor, because I didn't know actually for the longest time that he had played with you. Was he on the entire tour or no? And how did you meet him? Where was that connection? Because he was playing with Alanis Morissette. I don't know if that was before or after you, but
I'll tell you what happened. What happened was I had to tour Rat, and we needed a drummer, and we were looking everywhere for a drummer. Couldn't find any ever. And somebody said to the guitar player I was working with, "Oh, I know this kid down on Laguna Beach. He's awesome. He's never played with anybody big or anything like that, but he's so awesome, and he's just a great." Anyway, so he said, "Okay, we'll give it a shot." And what the fuck, you know? And he drove up in his old beat up truck. He drove up to LA and came and auditioned for us.
Oh wow!
And he was greener than green. He'd never done any big shows. He'd never done anything in his entire life up to the other than, you know, like little tiny bands, you know, like whatever. Anyways, and he wasn't the fabulous drummer that he turned into at the time. He was green as green, and he played everything at 50 million miles an hour. And we were like, holy shit, I don't know. But except for the fact that this guy is just beaming star and love and light, and he was just a joy to be around. And we loved him so much, we went, fuck it, we're going to get him anyway.
Welcome to All 80s Rock and Talk 4680Q. SCN here. Hope you're doing well, my friend. Episode number 8 is coming your way right now. Of course, I will be joined by Bobby R. Rock and Michael Hansen. But today's topic, here's what happened, okay? I was heading to Boston, Mass. Said to Bobby Rock, "What do you want to talk about next week?" You know, we record our podcast normally on a Tuesday night. I get home Monday. I don't have a lot of time to think about it right now. Too busy. And BR, as sometimes he is known, sometimes as BS as well. But anyway, so what about keyboards and kind of electronics in 80s music? And I was always a big fan of it. Huge fan of Depeche Mode, The Cure, Duran Duran, Howard Jones, Platinum Blonde, Images in Vogue, Thompson Twins, Yaz. List goes on and on. And for you rock fans, of course, 5150 by Van Halen had keyboards, a ton of it on that album. And of course, electronic drums that Alex Van Halen played. So we're going to chat about that. And I wanted to get Michael Hansen's perspective as to kind of what happened in Glass Tiger in the 80s, because, of course, they came out in the mid-80s, and I was curious to know about synthesizers, electronic drums, click tracks, all of those type of things. This episode is not really about, like, new wave bands, but more about some of the technology. So we're going to get to that right here in episode number 8. And our feature interview today is my good friend Sass Jordan. She's been playing all over Southern Ontario right now. She released an album live in New York, 94, which came out, I believe, in April. And I did this conversation a couple of months ago. But she did have an album in the 80s, 1988, Tell Somebody. That great hit, So Hard, was on that album. But Sass is super amazing. Has so many great stories. And of course, Taylor Hawkins played with Sass Jordan, and he is part of this album, Live in New York, 94. So Sass Jordan is the featured interview. We're getting to it right now. It's episode number 8, my friend. Please give us a like on Facebook, All 80s Rock and Talk. This is 4680Q. We have no great minds on this program. I don't know what you're talking about.
How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well, Michael. You?
I'm doing excellent. I just got back from, I forget, it's a long story. Anyway, I'm doing good.
That's a huge glass of wine.
Here's Michael. You have.
It is?
Why is it on Tuesday when we do this? I have coffee. Have wine, and Bobby has beer. I need to change my ways.
I can explain exactly why that happens. It's because I drink wine every night.
Because you're committed to the cause. I get it. Yes. So here we are, episode 8, and I don't know what we're doing. I asked Bobby what he wanted to talk about. And for a guy who doesn't play keyboards, I don't think he does, know much about keyboards or even what key the keyboard could possibly be in. We're going to talk about keyboards and electronics, or what are we doing again?
Okay. Little do you know, I do have some years in piano.
Oh, good. As a 4-year-old, I'm sure.
That's no, I from 7 to 12.
Very nice. Very nice, Bobby.
Oh, well, I try.
Can we broaden this, though, to talk about the 80s being kind of like the electronics, the drumming, the drum machines, the synthesizers? Can we open it up to that?
Absolutely.
Sure, man. Oh, okay. Well, for me, I don't know if you're going to go there, Bob. So, 1981, 82, 83, maybe 84, it all seemed to still be going to 24-track tape. And for people who don't know what tape is, it's like 2-inch tape that in a reel to reel. And it's when you go to edit something in, that is to replace a piece of music, you have to use a razor blade and cut it, and then they throw the pieces on the floor like the Beatles used to do, and then they put it back together with Scotch tape or a special tape. And that eventually came to an end in around 85, I'm guessing. Bobby, you could probably correct me there, but if I'm off base. But and I know that around then, because 84, because that's when we went out to Vancouver with Jim Vallance to record the first Glass Tiger record. And that's when things switched over. And I remember Jim Vallance, who produced lots of great artists, Heart and, of course, Brian Adams. So we met Jimmy out there, and he was into the latest and greatest, which now had switched over into computers. And we're laying down tracks on a computer. I'm going, what the heck is this about? So that sort of happened. And when that happened, it changed everything. So keyboards then obviously sort of morphed into much more complex stuff, where eventually then you could play a set of drums and it would trigger. I forget what the name of it was. Our keyboard player, Sam Reed, would know, but Jim had a trigger thing going on where you hit a normal snare drum, but you can have any snare drum you want that'll pop up. And that started happening. And of course, the Mini Moog made an appearance. With other keyboards like the Selena, which is now just a patch. A Selena, they used to buy a great big gigantic string machine called a Selena just to get a string sound. And that's how it sort of all started to evolve from keyboard to keyboard. If you wanted a B3 organ, you would go get a B3. If you wanted a Selena sound, you'd get a Selena. So you had to buy individual instruments, get individual sounds. And then that later, of course, grew into now you can get any sound you want with just a bunch of software. But it was a big change in the way we did things because it made editing very, very easy. Although we did lose something in the process. I don't know if you guys agree, but not going to tape now is not the greatest. Tape's got noise and people don't like noise now. Everything's got to be perfect. Problem with digital is it's too slick, I think. But things changed that day and they've never gone back.
So was there ever a Gomez to go along with the Selena? Anyway, I'll be here all evening. Here's my question to you, Michael. Now that you could punch in, how many Glass Tiger songs did you record that you did not record the full drum track, but punched in somewhere to get a piece of the track? Or did that not happen because you're that fucking good?
No, I'm not that fucking good. I think the first record, which was done at Morin Heights Studio, we just arrived at Morin Heights in Quebec. A beautiful studio, of course. Sting recorded there. I stayed in Sting's room. Stones had recorded there, I believe. Nobody wanted to stay in Keith Richards' room. But I do. It's like, which one's Keith? Okay, well, I'm not going in there. But I remember recording on tape. So I believe they were still running 24-track tape on the first record. And we got to Diamond Sun, the second record. We were definitely fully digitized, if that was your question.
Well, I just didn't know if you recorded all of those songs in full or if there were moments of the songs where you said, okay, in the right before the chorus, I'm going to repunch in here and just do that drum fill or whatever it is. That's all. Right. I'm going to remember all that, but I didn't know.
Still do that. Yeah, you can still punch in, but you wanted to keep that to a minimum because that means people were bringing razor blades out and start cutting tape. But I believe we did the first one on 24-track tape, and it was a pain in the ass like it always is, but boy, do they sound good. Masters, you know?
So when you were, we're talking about the electronic age in the 80s, did you play any like Simmons drums or any of that stuff, or were yours all acoustic besides triggers?
Yep. There's great pictures of me playing, what was the club in Richmond Hill? Oh my gosh. The Blackhawk Inn, I think, in Richmond Hill. We played there quite a bit as Tokyo pre-Glass Tiger, and I had a full kit of Simmons electronic drums. Now, the thing is I play like, I modeled myself a little bit after John Bonham back in those days, and I played the hell out of those things. I broke every single pad, every single one of them. Had big cracks in them, and all the chips were flying off them. It was horrible. You're only supposed to just tippy-tap your way around that shit, right. And I'm not that kind of player, so I hated it. But it was very, you know, and I ran.
Right.
I ran so far. Boom, 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 boom. You know, that's when that happened.
So... talking about songs, so I wrote these down because in the 80s, don't laugh, I was listening to Yaz, the Thompson Twins, Platinum Blonde, Howard Jones, Duran Duran, Depeche Mode, and The Cure. That's why when I met Bobby and he wanted to play AC/DC, I was like, sure, whatever that is, let's do that.
There you go, Bobby. Good work, Bobby.
Because that's what I was listening to. So there was highly electronic instruments in those songs, and you mentioned Aha. So Bobby R. Rock, I want your take on what was happening in the 80s and electronics, whether it be keyboard synthesizers or electronic drums or whatever.
Well, you know what? It's an interesting time because we went from the 70s, which is really raw, just really true sound, to bands starting to utilize keyboards. And when you think of the iconic songs, like The Final Countdown, like keyboards made, they were the riffs, like they were the main riffs that stuck in your head. You know, and then it kind of morphed from, well, even Jump.
I was just going to mention Jump because to rock fans, that was their first taste of something that was driven by keyboards,
which I'll come back to, but, yeah, like you had now keyboards making the riffs and the main parts of the song stick in your head. And then all of a sudden you went to piano, becoming more prevalent in hits with the ballad, right?
Home Sweet Home.
Is Home Sweet Home, Right Here Waiting, come on, you know, all that great stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it really, really cool. And of course, you know, Journey, John Cain with the stand-up keyboard, you know, that looked like a guitar, you know, around his neck, and he's dancing around with it. It was pretty cool. But I was going to say, the interesting thing is a band like Van Halen, who was predominantly, you know, your down and dirty, you know, four-piece rock band. Now their biggest hits in the 80s are coming out with keyboards, you know. And it was amazing how their fans just embraced it and how they grew their fan base. They exploded after that.
Totally. And it would make that jump riff changed my life. When I heard that, I thought I died and gone to heaven. As soon as you hear whoop, whoop, woo, 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 woo. I'm like, oh my God, it's fantastic. That was cool. That was pretty cool.
And no one lost their mind because a guitar virtuoso was playing keyboards. Nowadays, if that happened, everybody would lose their mind. Oh my God, what's Eddie doing? This is, you know, this is crazy. You know, but people just embraced it.
A really great example, I think, of that was Rush. They had a huge transition, and there was a big fight between, or a disagreement between Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee. I think Alex was complaining that Geddy was starting to use synthesizers in their songs, and Geddy came back and said, "Well, all those pedals that are on the ground in front of you are synthesizers, dude." Yeah. So they got into this big thing, and of course, as I'm sure Shane will know, I only listened to the first four or five records from Rush, and after that, I gave up. But when their keyboard transition, I wasn't that, you know, into it too much, but they did come out with some beautiful stuff. But there is a really good example of a pure rock band trio suddenly adapting keyboards into everything they did and having a bit of an internal riff about it. But it did change things vastly, especially the Mac computer and the editing process in the studio, which changed everyone's life overnight. It was bizarre, you know?
Well, it's funny because I know a lot of Van Halen fans who are, you know, classic Van Halen fans are not going to like this comment, but 5150 is the best Van Halen album.
Oh, I love that record.
Right. Not only
absolutely
was produced by Mick Jones from Foreigner, but Alex Van Halen played electronic drums on the entire album. It's just when they went out to play live, he also had to incorporate the, because they were playing the other albums, obviously, as well, and more keyboards. And really, it attracted someone like me who wasn't a big fan. I hate to say this. I am now kind of a Van Halen one, you know, but I didn't listen to it back then. But I went back to revisit it after I heard 5150. Different singer, I get it, but still, that 5150 was a game changer for me for electronics, both keyboard synthesizers and for drums. And I was always big on like Platinum Blonde, you know, just the drumming and song. It doesn't really matter. And the way that the drum fill sounded was so different than what you'd heard before. And I think you either loved it or you hated it. But, you know, I kind of really got into that at that time. Do you have any of the favorite songs, Bobby, from the age of electronics in the mid 80s?
Oh, like bands like Aha, Take On Me. I crossed over from, you know, your rock stuff into bands like Aha because of that, you know.
Right.
Yeah, of course. Your rock, like I already mentioned, Final Countdown, which was huge for Europe. Great mention of 5150. Why Can't This Be Love? Like, come on, that's great
track. What's the ballad off that record? Was that it? I think it is. That's a great song.
Well, that and Dreams and
Although I would argue that you can't. I don't know. I mean, 5150 is. I love that record, but Van Halen 1 is absolutely iconic. I mean, that opening song. Running with the Devil, that starts off with about, it sounds like 20, I think it was like 20 car horns all put together. It just, you listen, when you find that out later, you realize these guys weren't fucking around. That was a record and a half. I liked Deja too, In the Heat of the Moment. An interesting point about that song by Asia, and he didn't know it. If you listen to it, it speeds up in the chorus, like crazy speeds up. So there was definitely no metronome. That's another thing that started to happen. They brought metronomes into recording because right. now you're on a grid. To hear it, to explain all in one shot, like even keyboards were already around in the 70s. Think of Styx.
Right.
Styx was one of my top four bands in the 70s. And they were obviously, it was all Moog stuff. Mini Moog, right?
Deep Purple had an organ, like, right.
Yeah, yeah. They had it all. But what really changed things, they were still playing to tape. What changed was, is when 84 came along, all of a sudden you're playing to a grid. So you're on a grid. So you know what, doesn't matter who's playing, particularly the drummer though, is going to hear this. This was my whole life. It never stopped. Even on stage, they were blasting that through my monitors. At like, we were playing in Boy George and Maple Leaf Gardens, and I'm hearing tonk, 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 tonk coming through my monitors, and it's going out into Maple Leaf Gardens, and I'm going, well, this is a bit embarrassing, you know. But it changed things because now you got to play to a grid, and everything is edited on the grid, where it used to be you got to get the take. That's the big one. You had to get the takes right in the studio. And in 84, 85, 86, when things really changed over to Mac and they had the programs rolling, you didn't have to play right every time. You could just keep going back to the well and do it over and over and over. And it changed the way that people do things, which makes me appreciate the 70s more than fucking ever, because everybody had to lay down tracks. It was amazing.
Absolutely. My question, though, Michael, is that you recorded albums, I'm sure, with Glass Tiger with a click track then, and then, or a lot of drummers were in the mid 80s, let's say. But when you played live, they didn't have in ears right back then. So what you were saying, either they had to pipe it through your monitor,
yeah,
or the band just played faster or slower depending on
you wear headphones,
right?
So because Sam, our keyboard player, would do songs like Ancient Evenings, it would have a sequencer, which is another aspect of the keyboards, which is why it's on the grid. Because a lot of sequencers started popping up going, right? So, you know, once you got the stuff going on, it has to be on the grid and you got to be able to play along with it. And you can't play the notes doing that unless you're a genius. You have to have a punctuated click in order to differentiate that from the music and from the verb and everything else that goes with it. So they would punch that through my monitors. And I lost the top end of my hearing now because of it for 8 years on the road.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
A little bit top mids of my hearing. Yeah. It was so loud sometimes I thought I was going to just fall off my stool. And I'd be yelling at the monitor guy going, turn it down, you know. And plus the audience could hear this boom, 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 boom click going behind me. I could hear it. I mean, I had to hear it above the drums. That was the problem. And I wouldn't wear phones because I didn't want to mess up my hair.
Huh? Stan, especially with the hair you had.
I knew Bobby'd have a laugh about that one too.
Big fan of hair. Hair is very important to me.
Yeah, you're doing okay, man. You're looking good, buddy. Looking good.
Did you ever record with a Lindrum for anything?
Yeah. Someday it was done on a Lindrum. The song Someday.
Right.
Yeah. And funny story behind that. I was arguing with Jim Vallance because I didn't get to be in the middle of everything all the time as a drummer. He was like, okay, Hanson, leave us alone. We got to do something here. And I'd be like, oh no, I'm not leaving. I'm in the middle of this music and I'm working. And he'd be like, so eventually he came up with a great idea to get rid of me. So he told me one day, he said, I want you to do me a favor. We're about to play Someday. I want you to go and write the music out for Someday. He goes, do you write out music? And I said, no, I don't read drum music. I don't read any music. He goes, perfect. Perfect. Go up in the corner and write the whole song out in drum music. He got rid of me for a day. I was sitting there writing music for no reason. He looked at it and went, yeah, very good, and threw it away. And then we programmed what I wrote, though, into the Lindrum. And you get that, and there's a sequencer there in Someday, which comes in right after that, too. It says, I believe it was the DX7, which is the Yamaha, I think.
Yeah.
Which was a huge, huge keyboard back then. Yes. Yeah. That was a big one.
And Bobby's never played to a click track.
Boy,
no. No, it's just the pounding in my head when Shane keeps talking.
Yeah, exactly. I understand that.
It won't go away, will it? It won't go away.
So you are a rock guy, Mr. Rock. That's why your last name is Rock. Yeah. Our porn star would be Cock, but it's not. So.
Oh, geez.
Anyway.
We're on the show, eh?
So give me some more of your favorites that had keyboards in them. You mentioned The Final Countdown, Take On Me by A-ha. What other ones stood out for you?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you can't go wrong with Runaway, Bon Jovi, right? Like, that's their first hit, right? And they still play. Oh my gosh, what else is there? I'm just thinking on the fly here. The Home Sweet Home is pretty iconic, and that's kind of where it leads to, you know, just the different ballads that started coming out with piano. So, I mean, yeah, keyboards, piano, but yeah, still huge for bands. Yeah.
So what do you say about bands like Howard Jones, Thompson Twins? Those two stand out, where the real hardcore musician says that's not really, you know, professional.
No, anybody who says that's crazy, those were the songwriting is just as good as any year, any decade. It's brilliant right. stuff.
Bobby,
no, sorry, you're asking Bobby. Go ahead, Bobby.
I'm asking both of you, whoever wants to answer it. I just
that it's not really what?
Well, a lot of virtuoso guitar players and drummers that were, you know, playing a very complicated style, if you will, looked at the Thompson Twins and Howard Jones and said, this is a fucking joke. How is this on radio? There's nobody that's really doing anything, but they were great songs and you always remembered them. You knew all the lyrics. If you liked the band, obviously you hummed to them, whatever, you went to see the band play. So that's my point. What do you think of that?
I just kind of think that, you know, a lot of virtuoso players were probably, they're obviously smart enough to know the difference between, you know, styles of music and what right. makes a song a hit, right? So nobody's going to really complain or hack on somebody for being successful with a great song. You know, different 100%. People that are great guitar players or great drummers, you know, they had their own kind of style and music.
Right, right. Well, because I just remember being in high school and I had, you know, like somebody who would wear a Metallica or Judas Priest t-shirt and they would be like, Duran Duran is not really a band. They don't really play much. They suck. And yet when you listen to the band and you get it broken down, you know, are you okay, Michael? Are you getting attacked by a bee?
Yeah, a wasp just came after me. It got in my hair. I'm okay. I've been hit.
But a lot of those guys would say, you know, that's not really, you know, complicated music. And that's not true at all. In fact, it's quite the opposite of that. And any song that Duran Duran put out on radio that was a hit was well written, well structured, and the players played the parts they needed to play to make the songs what they were, you know.
I even liked Blinded by Science by Thomas Dolby.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff. It was so sassy, cool, man. There was great stuff. It allowed people to really expound on a theme and really come up with amazing stuff. Everything from Hall & Oates doing Man Eater to, and then of course you got Madonna using keyboards throughout the time, right? I hear like the biggest act in the world. Had it was all keyboard stuff started by that DJ that she paired up. I think his name was Jelly Bean or something in New York. So that was all born on the New York DJ scene, and keyboards were the thing. And for me, I was into it way earlier anyway. Because as I said, Styx to this day still one of my favorite bands. The first couple of records, Grand Illusion, still my favorite, one of my favorite records of all time.
I just want to point this out that we are on episode number 8. And wow. I swear to you that Michael has mentioned Madonna in all 8 episodes.
Look, I got to tell you, when she,
that,
like,
telling you.
When she did Like a Virgin, I couldn't get over her eyebrows. I can't even talk about it.
By the way, Pink played last night in Toronto, and her opening, well, she had a couple of opening acts, but one of them was in between was a DJ.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't know. It's somebody who's tutored with her for a long time. I don't know who it is.
So keyboards took over in the 80s, and now, since then, there really hasn't been anything that shook the world until now, when now DJs are the new rock star. Now they're playing 60,000, yeah.
Right, Jason Aldean has had one for
for forever, as far as I know. Yeah. He has the DJ out that tours with him, plays, you know, well in between sets, and so did Carrie Underwood. So even the country stars are bringing DJs out, you know, to play music in between, as opposed to house music while the band's transitioning and stuff like that. So kind of crazy.
Well, if I was a rock band, I wouldn't want to be putting the DJ up in front before I went out on that stage, because you got people jumping up and down and going mad and dancing, and all of a sudden you come up and start playing a country tune. But anyway.
You know, we mentioned about keyboards, and piano, though, has taken a big part here, too, as well. Like Phil Collins, Take a Look at Me Now. So many Billy Joel songs. So many songs written on Listen to Your Heart by Roxette on piano, right? And you mentioned a few of the other ones before as well, like Journey, etc. So it's crazy how it kind of, the piano was always around, the organ was always around, the keyboards were always around, but they really became predominant in the mid 80s there. And I think that's I enjoyed it, so I'm not complaining about it. And I told you the bands I listened to, which were mostly keyboard driven, to be honest with you.
Yeah. The sequencer, you can't overlook it, because if you think about The Look by Roxette, it starts off, right? It really did give the world a groove to dance to for the first time ever. That was infectious. And once that keyboard sequencer started to filter into music, that changed the old keyboard thing even further. And again, you're playing to a grid. And I know that won't make sense to some people, but if you're a studio guy, like we understand studios and how to record, it did change our lives as musicians quite substantially.
Changed Bobby Rock's life.
Bobby never played to a grid. I God bless you, Bobby. I wish I hadn't have ever played to a grid. I hate it.
What else do you want to talk about?
Well, it's interesting too, because actually keyboards came in at a perfect time, because it gave music, because keyboards are clean, they're programmed. You can make any sound you want. You can make your own identifiable sound, and it gave music a reason to be crisp and clean and processed and mechanical. And it definitely made it work.
Speaking of reason and keyboards, what about Reason to Live by Kiss? Anyway, let's move on.
Okay. I was going to say, for people who are listening to this, who don't understand quite what the impact of keyboards are, if you're not a musician doing this day by day, Maxwell Silverhammer must have been recorded in about 68, I'm guessing. And it had keyboards in it. In fact, Abbey Road had a lot of keyboards in it. The difference being that back then, when they were using keys, even the Beatles were using keys and synthesizers. Well, they had a guy named Magic Alex. It's a long story, but he was a guy down the street who had all kinds of electronic gadgets. He turned out to be a sham. But basically, the Beatles locked into some great keyboard sounds, especially in Here Comes the Sun. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. Those are all beautiful lines that were written and played on keys. But they were, for people who want to picture this, if they're interested, those went straight to tape. So the tape is rolling, you play them live, and whatever you play, you're stuck with. That's it, unless you go back and redo the whole piece. Right. So it was played, now, as I said, playing to a grid. And the reason why I keep bringing this up, I sound like a broken record, but it's a huge, huge piece of musical history, because at that point, you're no longer playing the part right every time. You can mess it up, you can do what you want, you can time code it, you can put it into perfect time and quantize it, which is called quantizing, which is what we do now with music. And it's taken, quite honestly, it's taken the Jimmy right out of music, if you ask me. I prefer tape. I wish we went back to tape. I'd be right there with Bobby and you and just go back and just record the way it is. Do it right the first time. Have a great time doing it. Don't let computers run your life, sort of thing.
I totally agree. But you know what? Again, they had a place in the 80s. This podcast is about the 80s, and they were important in the 80s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, a
ton of radio hits were made because... What are you laughing at? What were you looking up?
Who?
You.
Nothing.
I can tell when your screen goes black that you're looking up something.
I was looking up...
Say, tell us.
And I couldn't find any.
You're trying to what?
I was looking up some additional talking points and I couldn't find any. Where's Michael?
I don't know. Did he leave? Maybe he Maybe it's
what did you say?
I don't know.
Did you upset Michael?
I did. I think I said things I shouldn't have, and then he left and said something bad about the Glass Tiger in the 80s.
Michael, where are you?
Where are you, Michael? Anyway, I don't know where he went. So,
all right, maybe you had enough talking about.
Maybe exactly.
Yeah.
All right, so that does it. I don't think he's signing back in, so he may never be on the podcast again. We don't know.
I think he's done. I think episode 8. Was he only signed on for 8 episodes?
Maybe that's it. That could be it. I'm not sure. Well, I'll check the notes, the contract.
Yeah. Jeez. Mm. And he was getting swarmed by hornets, and so maybe the hornets use his hair as a nest.
Yeah, it could have been. Could have got stung. Maybe he's allergic. Oh, does he have an EpiPen?
Now you got me worried.
Now I'm worried. I know. Okay. Maybe I'll try to call him, see how he's making out.
All right. Well, let me know.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay.
I'm leaving. Bye now.
Activate dance mode countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right. Thanks, as always, to one Bobby R. Rock and Michael Hansen. I hope Michael's not mad with us. I don't know. He just kind of left and said, fuck you, people. No, I'm kidding. A little bit of technology issues. Isn't that funny in this episode? time for the featured interview portion of the program. Sass Jordan, she released Live in New York 94, which came out in April. And so many great songs on this album. And Taylor Hawkins, yes, that Taylor Hawkins, played drums with Sass Jordan. She's going to tell the story about how she met Taylor Hawkins. And, of course, Taylor played with her first and then went on to play with Alanis Morissette. And, of course, some small little upstart band called the Foo Fighters. But that story is coming your way. Sass has been all over Southern Ontario this summer playing some gigs, which is great. Haven't seen one yet. I haven't been around, but I do hope to catch one. So many great songs. She did have an album come out in 1988 called Tell Somebody. And I love that guitar riff at the beginning of So Hard. It is our featured interview on All 80s Rock and Talk. Sass Jordan.
Hi, this is Sass Jordan, and you are listening to Shane Christopher Neal.
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. Great, great, great.
Awesome.
Great to talk to you.
You too. I know we have a mutual friend, that being Gary Borden. I believe he plays guitar with you.
Oh, I love Gary. Yes. That's awesome. That's amazing.
Yeah, I've known Gary for a long time, and I live down in Niagara, not far from Gary, and I've hung out with many times over the years, and yeah, super nice guy, great player, and that's awesome.
Just a wonderful human being, too.
Absolutely.
Well, you must be, too, if you're friends with Gary.
Oh, thank you. Well, we'll see after this interview. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's all great, my dear.
This is going to be a lot of fun. GiantFM.com, MusicLikeMagazine.net as well. But you have a brand new album that's come out, and we're going to talk about that. But before I get to that, though, I do have a couple questions. First of all, I got to tell you, back in late 1988, it was, when Tell Somebody came out, the song So Hard, it was on repeat in my vehicle on cassette, I think, over and over. And it was just such a great song, the melody, the guitar at the beginning. And when you listen to that album, right, when you listen to that album now, like what, 35 years later, what do you think of it? Do you ever listen to it? Or what are your thoughts about it now?
Well, I don't listen to it.
Fair enough.
But if I did, I think, actually, you know what? I heard a song from it the other day, and that's the strangest. I don't know how the fuck I heard it. I have no idea. I don't think it was the radio. I don't know where it came from, but anyway. And I could hear my brother's voice in the background. And so it took me right back into him being in the studio with me and my, so it kind of catapults me into that time for a second. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And so long ago.
I know. Crazy to think about that. And I believe on the 30th anniversary, you put out some 7-inch vinyl or something. Did you not of that album?
Probably, yeah. Probably. Yeah. I have no idea. I can't remember any of it.
You know, as a female artist too, and I've done so many interviews over the years with Lee Erin and Cyndi Lauper and Shania, but like when I think of the females that were coming through in the 80s and 90s, who did you look up to as maybe a role model in the industry? Did you find, was there one person or a couple of people that you looked up to as females? Because back then it was a lot harder, I think, than it is today for females in the music business.
That's a fabulous question. I'm just thinking right now as he's saying that, like, what it was in the 90s, who did I look up to? Well, there really were not any female artists that I knew of who were doing what I was doing.
Right.
Except, I mean, from the 90s per se, like I have always adored Bonnie Raitt, for example, but I wouldn't say she was from the 90s, you know, right. She was in the 70s, and she's from the now actually, but you know what I mean? But she wasn't specific to the 90s. Well, she had great, you know what I'm saying? Anyway, so Bonnie Raitt, I loved Michelle Angelicello. I don't know if you know her.
Yeah, I know the name. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, she was awesome. And probably still is. I hate saying was. I don't know what, but you know, there's just so much going on. It's impossible to keep up with it all.
Right.
And, but there, it wasn't. Yeah. And I don't know if it's easier. In some ways it's easier today, and in some ways it's more challenging, just like it was then. In some ways it was easier then, and some ways it was more challenging. You know, we live in a world of duality for sure.
Right. Absolutely.
Everything has both ends of it, you know, so.
Well, that's it. That's a fair answer. I just wasn't sure if there was somebody that was specific in your mind that you had looked up to. But fair enough. Let's go on to this album, though. Live in New York, 94. Number one, New York is my favorite city. I'm heading there actually in a couple of weeks. How come you picked this specific show to release the album for?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, it was one of my favorite records that I've ever made, the Rats tour. So mm-hmm. It was Rats. So that's one reason. Another reason is that people had been asking for a live recording for the longest time, and I just never, you know. And then somebody who works with me said, hey, I found this particular recording, and it's really good. Maybe this is what maybe you should put this out. Plus, it's the one-year anniversary of Taylor
right.
leaving us. So this might be a beautiful way to celebrate him, you know.
Absolutely.
And all of those things combined, and the fact that it was, you know, sonically decent enough to do, you know, to put out it, all of that combined is really what the reason is.
So with Taylor, because I didn't know actually for the longest time that he had played with you. Was he on the entire tour or no? And how did you meet him? Where was that connection? Because he was playing with Alanis Morissette. I don't know if that was before or after you, but
I'll tell you what happened. What happened was I had to tour Rats and we needed a drummer and we were looking everywhere for, I couldn't find any ever. And somebody said to the guitar player I was working with, oh, I know this kid down on Laguna Beach. He's awesome. He's never played with anybody big or anything like that, but he's so awesome. And he's just a great, anyway. So he said, okay, we'll give it a shot. And what the fuck, you know? And he drove up in his whole beat up truck. He drove up to L.A. and came and auditioned for us.
Oh, wow.
And he was greener than green. He'd never done any big shows. He'd never done anything in his entire life other than, you know, like little tiny bands, you know, like whatever. Anyways, and he wasn't the fabulous drummer that he turned into. At the time, he was green as green, and he played everything at 50 million miles an hour. And we were like, holy shit, I don't know. But except for the fact that this guy is just beaming star and love and light, and he was just a joy to be around. And we loved him so much, we went, fuck it, we're going to get him anyway, and he'll learn. And he did. And then what happened was at the end of the tour, that whole year, I mean, we went to Europe, he'd never done anything like this in his life. He was just ecstatic to be doing what he'd always dreamed of doing. And of course, what was going to be his life. Anyways, at the end of the tour, the last night of the tour was in Los Angeles, and my manager at the time had a friend who was a manager, strangely enough. His name was Scott, and he had this artist, this Canadian artist, that he was looking for a band for, and he said, well, seeing as Sass has, you know, finished the tour and not going to be playing for a while, do you mind if we, like, come and see the band, and maybe we hire a couple of guys? And needless to say, it was Alanis Morissette, and they did.
Wow.
They hired Taylor and Nikki, my guitar player Nikki, and within 5 months, it was the biggest thing in the entire world.
Crazy. And because I was watching a video also in 1994, the European Festival, and Taylor was playing, so I wasn't sure, but that's awesome. And what did you think then, let me ask you, as his career obviously just exploded, and what he did with the Foo Fighters, were you sitting there over the years just thinking, wow, this guy started with me, man, and here we are watching one of the most, or probably one of the greatest drummers of all time, really?
Yeah, well, and definitely one of the most beloved, that's for sure.
Right.
What did I think? Well, see, Taylor never ever, Taylor was the type of human being that never forgot what you did for him, right, in his opinion. You know what I mean? He was just a magnificent human being. And so Taylor and I were friends to the day he died. And we talked all the time, and we texted with each other all the time. Like, he never went away. But to me, what I would think when I'd see him in his soaring stratospheric career path, was I was right. I knew it. Everybody knew it. There was nothing special about me. Trust me. Everybody freaking knew it. You just stood in the room with him and you just knew he was destined for greatness.
Wow.
He was, you know, it was beautiful, and nobody would have deserved it more, in my opinion. And he never, ever stopped telling me that how grateful and appreciative he was that I, so to speak, gave him his first break. But the fact is, if it wasn't me, it would have been someone else, and he would have done the same thing, trust me.
Well, it sounded like you have a great relationship, or you did have one with him. Do you remember where you were when you heard the news that he passed away?
Yeah, I know exactly where I was, because I didn't believe it. But I was at home, and it was about 10 p.m. at night, and I got a text from my drummer, Cass, and he said, oh my God, Seth, did you see what the Foo Fighters just posted? And I said, no, what are you talking about? And he said, well, go look. So I did. And I thought, oh, this is a joke. Like, this is one of those, you know. And then within 10 minutes, it was clear that that wasn't the case. So it was a horrific experience.
Well,
I don't like thinking about it.
And I'm so sorry about that.
It's not your fault. I just, a lot of.
Well, this is a great tribute that you did this with him playing on the album. And I have to ask you, what else is on your bucket list? You put out a couple of blues albums too, right, in 2020?
Yeah.
Rebel Moon Blues and then Bitches Blues. And what's on your bucket list, you know, coming up in the next, let's say, 5 years? New music, like new rock music or no?
Yeah, I think so. It's so hard for me to predict where because I'm very, I get an idea, let's do it now. You know what I mean? But I don't necessarily have an idea before, but definitely more rock music for sure.
Good.
And I'm interested in fusion-y types of stuff. And I'm, you know, there's so many things that I'm interested in, but the main theme for me with music going forward, it always has been, but at this point in my life, this is absolutely the whole heart and soul and reason I want to do it, is healing of myself and healing of anyone else who gets the same vibration from it. That's all I really care about. I don't care about anything else.
That's awesome. And I'm glad you're going to put new music out because, you know, you've had some killer albums. And what I like is you've got this album out right now, and it's going to be out in vinyl too, I believe, soon. And not only yourself, but I did an interview last week with Harry Hess of Harum Scarum, who's got 30 years of mood swings. Andy Curran went back and re-released an album. So it's great to see the artists that I grew up listening to in high school and college are putting these albums back out, or maybe, you know, something you've never heard before, like the one that you're
creating new stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Can you tell me a story here about
What's the Van Halen? I went to your website. I know you wrote something fairly substantial on Van Halen there and Eddie. And mm-hmm. So what's the connection there? You seem to have known them, both Alex and mm-hmm. Eddie. And did you tour with them or what?
No, God, no. No, it was a, how do I summarize this quickly? Let's see. It was a bizarre twist of circumstances, as most things usually are. And they had called me and said, we are looking to do some new music and we want to hear what it sounds like with somebody singing on it. Would you be able to help us out? Just like so that we'd give us an idea of what it would sound like when somebody's singing on these songs that we're writing, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay. Jesus Christ, this is Van Halen. I grew up with fucking Van Halen. What the hell? Okay. And unbeknownst to me, they were actually looking for a singer for their band because they had just broken up with Sammy Hagar. But I didn't know that. The story they gave me was that they were looking for somebody to just help them hear what the song sounded like with a singer on them. Now, what happened is I spent about 4 months with them at Ed's house. When I say 4 months, because I lived down the street, so I'd go there like every couple of days. I'd be there all day. And do you think we ever did a shred of music? No. In fact, what happened was I was what I like to call their bum boy. So I was the one that was sent out for cigarettes and beer. And then we'd sit around for hours on end with them and they would tell me stories and then they'd have a fight and then they'd, you know, listen to the new record that I was making and then we'd go out. It was an incredible time during which not one note of music was played, A, and B, not one single photograph was taken. So everybody just has to believe me on this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'm telling the truth because I would never have thought of such a great story.
I'm going to read otherwise. It's on your website.
Yeah,
and like I started, I started getting into it. I was like, oh my God, this is long. I'm going to have to read it when I get more time. So, speaking of photos, on the album that's coming out, the Gatefold, mm-hmm. you're going to have some photos that you took during the Rats tour, correct?
Yeah. Well, not me because I rarely took photographs, but, my tour manager and percussion player guy, these are shit photos, but they're amazing.
Perfect.
In other words, they're the best. Because they're not, you know what I mean? Like they're wrecking wacky. Oh my God. Yeah. So absolutely. It's an amazing collage. It really is, especially for me. Cause I look at it and I go, I don't even know that person myself. I don't even remember that person. You know what I mean? It's like so fucking weird.
That is awesome. And there's good news and bad news. Well, the bad news is for me. The great news is you're playing in Kitchener, Ontario on July the 22nd. The bad news for me is I'm going to be in Boston, so I won't be
here. But
I know.
Bummer, dude.
I know.
Gary's going to be there.
I know. And I hope that you're going to play more shows in Ontario.
Well, we got a bunch. They're on the website.
Good.
There are a bunch. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I only saw a handful.
Me and Kim Mitchell, my fave.
That is amazing.
And
this is a great album. Live in New York, 94. And one last question, because I looked at where it was recorded when it said South Street Seaport. I like that's by Pier 17, I think. But where?
Yes.
Like, is there a hall there or something? I don't know where.
It was outside.
Oh, it was outside. Ah, okay.
It was like a radio, an afternoon radio presentation kind of thing, which is why it's so short.
Yeah,
we only did like 9 songs.
Yeah, I saw that.
Eight, oh, 9 songs. Yeah, yeah. So, and that's why it sounds so good because it was recorded with the radio. It was like a live radio thing. You know how radio stations do like a promotional? So that's what it was.
This is old school. I love it.
That's unbelievable. Who isn't old school, buddy? Hell yeah.
That is awesome. I really appreciate your time. And Gary speaks very, very highly of you, not only as a boss, but certainly as a person and as a singer. So I do appreciate that.
Yeah. 4680Q.